You're listening to an episode of a Wondery Plus exclusive series. To continue listening, join Wondery Plus and enjoy ad-free listening to over 40,000 episodes, early access to your favorite podcasts, and more. Find Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's 1969. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin are aboard the lunar module of the Apollo 11, preparing to land on the moon. If all goes well, they'll be the first humans to do so. From the cockpit of the lunar module, Eagle, they can see every crater, valley, and mountain peak scattered across the moon's surface, including their ultimate destination, the Sea of Tranquility. But back on Earth, at NASA's manned space center in Houston, Texas, things are the opposite of tranquil.
Apollo 11, this is Houston, over.
Mission Control is on high alert.
What's going on? The crew is saying that two of their warning alarms have been flashing every 10 seconds for the past few minutes.
Nobody knows what's causing it. With the whole world watching live on television and the lives of Apollo's crew members hanging in the balance, two Mission Control operators struggle to make an on-the-spot decision.
We still don't know what's causing those alarms. The crew is asking for guidance.
Will the system still be able to lead them to the surface safely, or should we have them aboard?
It's a tough call. Allowing the astronauts to land with the knowledge that some unidentified problem is causing their alarms to go off is a scary prospect.
Tell them to keep descending.
Tension hangs in the air as one of the operators turns back to the communication system.
Eagle, you're a go for landing, over.
The problem is far from solved. Mission Control still needs to figure out what's wrong with Apollo 11's computers. Even if the lander makes it to the moon, the astronauts still need to get back off the moon and fly back to Earth.
Give me whoever's in charge of the Apollo software. If this is a bug, we've got serious problems.
No one knows the onboard software better than the team at MIT's Instrumentation Laboratory. They built it. And at the helm of the software engineering division is a computer scientist named Margaret Hamilton.
Copy. I'll get MIT on the line. We need to talk to Margaret Hamilton right away.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Wondery, I'm Stephen Johnson, and this is American Innovations. This is the first episode of a special series we're doing with Smithsonian Magazine for Women's History Month. We're going into the Smithsonian's museums, archives, and back offices to learn more about the women whose inventions changed the world and our lives. Each week, we'll feature one object from their collections and tell you the story of the woman behind it.
It's a piece of paper, and it's striped. It has green and white stripes across the side, and then it has sort of holes alongside the side.
That's Teasel Muir Harmony.
And I'm a curator of the Apollo spacecraft collection at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum.
The piece of paper she's got? It's
part of the software that was used to safely send humans to the moon and bring them back to Earth.
RYRZRSSBXB.
Paul Ceruzzi is curator emeritus in the Space History Department of the National Air and Space Museum. He's reading from the paper printout, which is filled with rows of computer code.
V, X, Y, and Z, that's the velocity. In other words, here's where you are and here's where you're going.
In the 1950s, when Margaret Hamilton was a high school and college student, there was no such thing as a computer science class. There were very few computers, period. And those that did exist were big and expensive. Computers with less processing power than an iPhone took up an entire room. It was the Wild West of computer science. And Margaret Hamilton, a savvy young woman with a knack for numbers, became one of the first pioneers of this new frontier.
Margaret was not that well known for many, many years, but just a few years ago, someone at the MIT Museum in Cambridge found a picture in the files of her standing next to a pile of these printouts in which they towered over her, and she's smiling and pointing to them, the implication being this is how much software they had to write to go to the moon.
Guided by mentors and colleagues, Hamilton taught herself to code, and went on to work on projects that had huge impacts on technological and human history. She even popularized the phrase that we now use to describe her field, software engineering. This is the story of the woman who put man on the moon. Hamilton graduated from a small liberal arts college in Indiana in 1958 with a bachelor's degree in math and a minor in philosophy. Her earliest role models were her father, a philosopher and a poet, and her grandfather, a writer, head schoolmaster, and Quaker minister. Like them, she wanted to use her intellect to tackle some of life's biggest questions. In 1959, Hamilton moved to Boston. She was 23 years old and planning to pursue a graduate degree in abstract mathematics, eventually. In the meantime, she got a temporary programming job at MIT to help support her husband, James, who was getting his law degree at Harvard. Her new boss would be Professor Edward Lorenz. He was one of the top meteorologists in the country. Lorenz brought Hamilton on board because of her aptitude for mathematics. He needed help because he was developing a computer program able to predict the weather with more accuracy than existing technology. Now, this was no small feat, considering that at the time, few people had ever heard of the term computer program, and even fewer could call themselves computer programmers. Less than a decade prior, a team of scientists at Princeton had proven that a computer could be used to numerically predict the weather. Ever since that experiment, conducted on the U.S. Army's ENIAC computers, meteorologists like Lorenz had set their minds on perfecting the technology. Little did Hamilton know, this seemingly temporary job would change the course of her career, and with it, the face of modern technology. Margaret Hamilton is in her boss's office at MIT. It's her first year on the job. Her boss, Lorenz, is standing in front of a chalkboard covered with complicated diagrams and equations, mathematical representations of the weather. At his side is an early desktop computer, the LGP-30. At first glance, it's unimpressive. It looks like two big metal desks attached to a typewriter. But it's critical to Lorenz and Hamilton's work. As they talk, the computer is clacking and humming along, running lines of code. Lorenz is a humble man, but it's clear that he's excited about a new assignment he has in mind for Hamilton.
Thanks for coming in today, Margaret. I want to run something by you. Now that you've gotten the hang of some of the basic coding languages, I think you're ready to start programming your own software.
Oh, wow.
Don't sound so surprised.
I guess I still think of myself as a mathematician, not a programmer.
That may be true, but I'm confident that you're up to it.
Hamilton thinks back to the long hours she spent poring over the new foreign languages of computer programming, binary code with its sequences of zeros and ones to represent every number and letter of the alphabet, and hexadecimal code, which uses the numbers 0 through 9, and then the letters A through F as shorthand for numbers 10 through 15. She had worked hard at it, but she had mastered it, after all.
You learned both programming languages pretty much all on your own, and quicker than I ever would have imagined. Designing and building an operating system that we can actually use for the weather experiment is the natural next step for you. Plus, I could use the help.
Hamilton considers this for a moment, remembering all the late nights she'd stayed up reading and scribbling annotations in a notebook after her husband James had gone to bed. It was painfully difficult work, but it filled her with the same curiosity and excitement that solving a difficult math problem had always instilled in her.
Okay, I'm game to try it.
Hamilton spends the next 2 years working on Lorenz's weather project. It's a crash course in what we now call software engineering. She's reading code, writing code, and more importantly, she's learning to design applications and build entire operating systems. By 1961, Hamilton was keen to put her programming skills to the test in another arena. So she started working at a new lab, a Defense Department Research and Development Center at MIT called Lincoln Laboratory. Hamilton was assigned to a project called Semi-Automatic Ground Environment, or SAGE for short. And this time, the stakes were much higher than predicting the weather more accurately. SAGE was designed to develop software to help the United States military search for unfriendly aircraft. Tensions were building between America and the Soviet Union. It was starting to look like things could ramp up into an all-out nuclear war. For the first time, Hamilton's work was a matter of national security. One day in the office, to make sure she's up to the task, Margaret's supervisors assign her to work on an impossibly difficult piece of software.
Hamilton, eh? We're going to start you out with this program for a radar system. We have all our new hires do this. Just take a look at the code and try to get it to run.
Sounds simple enough.
Well, don't get too overconfident. To be honest, we don't actually expect you to get this program to work. No one yet has managed it with outside help.
No one?
Hamilton looks from one supervisor to the other, a skeptical look on her face.
Yes, there's a slight complication with this program.
We hope you can decipher foreign languages as well as you can code, because the person who built this program thought it would be fun to write his notes on it in Greek and Latin. Good luck.
To everyone's surprise, perhaps even hers, Hamilton does get the program to work. Her supervisors at SAGE are blown away. She's the first person they've hired who figured it out on their own. Now they know they can trust her with even the most difficult programming tasks. Hamilton quickly moved on to developing software to detect Soviet aircraft in the event of an attack. She worked long hours to make sure it stayed running without errors. In fact, her and her colleagues at SAGE helped lay some of the groundwork for modern-day air traffic control systems. The lab was abuzz with activity, day and night. Dozens of operators sat at desktop monitoring consoles covered with buttons and switches to keep a close eye on their radar screens. If one of the computers ever crashed due to a software error, lights would flash and alarm bells would ring, and everyone, developers and computer operators alike, would come running to find out what the problem was. In the midst of this chaos, Hamilton developed a fascination with finding new and improved ways to debug her software. The other programmers called her software the Seashore Program because it ran so smoothly that it sounded like waves crashing on a seashore. It's 4 a.m. in the morning. Hamilton and her husband James are sleeping soundly. That is, until the phone rings. James hurries out of bed to answer the call. The voice on the other end is quietly frantic. They're asking for Margaret.
Margaret? Never mind, I'll get her.
Margaret stumbles out of bed.
Hello?
Hi, Mrs. Hamilton. Sorry to call so late or early. The thing is, I think something's wrong with your program. It doesn't sound like a seashore anymore.
Oh, there must be a bug. Thanks for letting me know. I'll be right over.
She hangs up the phone and starts quietly but quickly getting dressed.
What is it?
I need to go to the lab for a few hours.
What is it this time? Can they manage without you for a few hours?
No. And even if they could, I wouldn't be able to fall back to sleep. If there's a bug in my program and a Soviet plane were to fly over tonight, there's a chance that we'd miss it.
I suppose.
I'd better go, but I should be back by the time you leave for work.
If Hamilton's family felt that her work for Sage was demanding a lot of her time and attention, it was nothing compared to what was in store for them.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
American Innovations is brought to you by The Art of Shaving. If you've been listening to our show for a while, you've probably noticed that life in the past could be pretty rough, hence our constant need for innovation. Shaving is no exception, and The Art of Shaving is here to make sure that you enjoy a close, comfortable shave today and every day. The Art of Shaving's dedication to using high-quality essential oils and botanical ingredients in their award-winning products has now evolved into a collection that will help you with all your grooming needs from head to toe. Now is your chance to see what the four elements of the perfect shave really feel like. Listeners of American Innovations are invited to get 15% off their first order by using the promo code AI at checkout, online, or at any of the Art of Shaving stores. Again, that's code AI to get 15% off your first order and start enjoying your shave again. By 1964, tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union had grown deeper, and Hamilton could feel it when she went to work every day at MIT. The countries were locked into a heated race to be the first to reach the final frontier, outer space. So far, the Soviets seemed to be winning. They had sent the first satellite, man, and woman into space, Sputnik, Yuri Gagarin, and Valentina Tereshkova. America was desperate to beat them to the moon. And MIT had just the team to make it happen. They secured a NASA contract to develop software for the spacecraft that, if successful, would put the first man on the moon. With 5 years of programming experience now under her belt, Hamilton was first in line to get in on the action. As the head of the software engineering division at MIT's instrumentation lab, her job was to lead the team tasked with developing Apollo 11's onboard flight software. Under her leadership, the team worked to create the system that would guide and navigate the Apollo 11 spacecraft on its 8-day journey to the moon and back. Hamilton took her new position in stride, instilling in her team a strong sense of fun and camaraderie. They would go out for drinks and even had their own nerdy inside jokes. Hamilton loved the atmosphere of it all, but she was also acutely aware of the responsibilities that now rested on her shoulders. With astronaut lives at stake, failure was not an option. One night, Hamilton is out late at a party and is struck by a sudden realization. Some code she'd been working on for the Apollo software is flawed. She starts to gather her things and head for the exit.
Margaret, you leaving already? There's a lot of evening left.
It's past midnight. I'd stay if I could, but I actually just thought of something that I want to take care of at the lab.
You're going back to the lab? Now?
I know. I can't stay, and if I go home, now that it's on my mind, I won't be able to fall asleep anyway.
Since starting the Apollo project, Hamilton has been haunted by a creeping fear that the mission will somehow fail, and it will be all her fault. In her mind's eye, she can see newspaper headlines spreading the sad news that the Apollo spacecraft never reached its destination or crashed into a lunar mountain range. She imagines her name in black and white lettering, Margaret Hamilton, the woman whose software caused the disaster. She's determined not to let these visions become a reality.
It'll make me feel better to just go in and fix the error tonight.
Well, you sure are dedicated, Margaret. I'll give you that.
Thanks for having me. I'll try to stay later next time. Good night.
As a result of the added pressure on her shoulders, Hamilton developed new ways to detect and fix programming errors. The number of people working on Apollo's software had grown from just a handful of programmers to as many as 400. And because software wasn't taught at the time, Hamilton had to train her team in how to program, which, at the time, meant punching holes into stacks upon stacks of punch cards. The holes represented a series of commands in binary code that would operate the spacecraft during the mission. The punch cards were then processed on a massive mainframe computer that took up an entire room. Perhaps the most important step came when the team finished writing their code. The mainframe computer would then simulate what would happen if the code were guiding the Apollo lunar lander. After all, everything about this mission and the software was brand new. They couldn't just send astronauts into space, not knowing whether it would work or not. The team at MIT had a simulator of the Apollo command module, where one of two 70-pound computers on board the spacecraft was housed, complete with all the buttons, dials, switches, and displays that the astronauts would have in the actual Apollo cockpit. The simulator allowed Hamilton and her team of programmers to test their code and mimic in-flight conditions in a realistic setting. Through all of this grueling work, Hamilton sometimes brought her young daughter, Lauren, to the office with her. Lauren loved to see her mother working inside the command module simulator, acting like one of the astronauts. Sometimes, her mother even allowed her to play with the keyboard that controlled the software in the simulator. It was called a disk key, short for display and keyboard, and looked like a big calculator. One day, Lauren is playing around with the disk key. She clumsily presses buttons with her tiny hands and accidentally starts a pre-launch version of the software in the middle of a flight simulation. Hamilton looks up from the code she's working on and notices her daughter has just caused the navigation system to crash.
Oh no, Lauren, honey, did you crash the system? Let mommy see that, please.
As she examines her daughter's handiwork, that familiar fear rushes over her. This could be a big problem if it happened during the mission. She needs to talk to her colleagues at NASA.
Hello?
Hi there, this is Margaret Hamilton.
Ah, Margaret. To what do I owe the pleasure?
Well, me and a colleague were just running a flight simulation and found something odd.
How so?
We were running the software, guiding the spacecraft toward the moon. Everything was fine, but then mid-flight, we accidentally started up a pre-launch version of the software. The system didn't know how to handle it, and it crashed.
That certainly is odd, but I don't think there's any cause for concern.
I'm not so sure. If one of the astronauts made the same mistake during the mission, it could be catastrophic. I think we should try building fail-safes into the code to make sure that the software can account for human error.
No, we've been over this before. I don't like the idea of a computer having more control over the mission than our astronauts, for any reason.
But what if the astronauts make a mistake?
They can't make a mistake. They know that if they do, it's their lives on the line. They're trained to be perfect.
I know. NASA's astronauts are the closest thing we have to real-life superheroes. But even Superman has kryptonite. Nobody's perfect. That's where our software comes in. We can add a line of code to scan for these types of errors in the background and kick in only when it's entirely necessary. Trust me on this.
I'm not entirely sold, but I'll talk to the rest of the team.
In the end, the higher-ups at NASA weren't convinced. They believed a failsafe in the software was unnecessary. Astronauts would never make such an error. They were about to find out just how wrong that assertion was.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Over the next 4 years, Hamilton's team of programmers continued to tackle increasingly complicated tasks. Developing the in-flight software for the Apollo mission was complex, difficult, and required a tremendous amount of creativity and skill. But most people at NASA still thought of software development as a series of menial tasks, far less critical to the mission than, say, building a moon lander or training a team of astronauts to fly a spacecraft. In high-level meetings with NASA, Hamilton tried to change this attitude.
So tell me again, what's wrong with calling you programmers? That's what people doing this kind of work have always been called, as I understand it.
Yes, but the thing is, we're doing much more than programming. We're designing, inventing, problem solving. Personally, I think software engineering is a much more appropriate and accurate title for the work that we do.
Don't you have to build something to be an engineer? Like a bridge or a car?
We'll see who's laughing when my team's software puts two men on the moon.
Putting programmers in the same category as engineers was a radical concept at the time. But in due course, people came around to Hamilton's way of thinking, and the phrase software engineering eventually caught on. By the late 1960s, the software program produced by Hamilton and her engineers was nearly finished. But that was only the first step. After their lines of code had been fully tested in the simulations and all the bugs had been fixed, the software was sent to a nearby facility to be finalized. At the facility, a team of mostly female employees had the difficult task of stringing copper wires through small, donut-shaped pieces of metal called cores. A wire strung through the center of a core represented a 1 in binary code, and a wire passing alongside a core represented a 0. In this way, they were literally hard-coding the computer memory that would guide the Apollo spacecraft to its destination. Many of these women were former seamstresses, hired for their dexterity. Hamilton lovingly called them the LOLs, or Little Old Ladies. In return, she earned the nickname Rope Mother, because a completed line of code, hardwired in this way, looked like a long cable or rope. By 1969, the onboard flight software for the Apollo 11 mission was complete. There was nothing left for Hamilton and her team to do but wait and see if their hard work would pay off. They were finally ready for liftoff. It's July 20th, 1969. Hundreds of millions of people around the world are tuned in, waiting to see if Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong will be the first men to land on the moon. People are so glued to their televisions that Walter Cronkite, the anchorman for CBS Evening News, has been narrating the mission around the clock. He's barely taken a few hours off here and there to sleep. Families, friends, and colleagues are crowded around rabbit-eared television sets, their breath bated, waiting to see history unfold before their eyes. Mission Control has just given the lunar lander the go-ahead to continue their descent. The spacecraft carrying the crew is getting closer and closer to the Sea of Tranquility on the moon's surface. And the American public is watching, waiting to see man's first steps on the moon. But behind the scenes, in Texas, Mission Control is tense for another reason. Alarms are flashing every 10 seconds in the Apollo lunar module. And neither the astronauts nor Mission Control can figure out why. They're relying on the software engineers to determine what exactly is going wrong. In Cambridge, at the MIT Instrumentation Lab, the mood is anxious. Based on the information they're getting from Mission Control, Hamilton and the other software engineers can tell the astronauts' computer system is overloaded with too many tasks. It's sluggish, running at 80% of its normal speed. But why? No one is exactly sure. Hamilton can't take her eyes off the lab's desktop display, showing the spacecraft's trajectory. Mere minutes remain until the landing module is set to reach its destination. All she can do is watch and wait.
Contact light.
Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent. Host control, both autos. Descent engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Okay,
oh my God, it worked.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Hamilton and her team have no time to celebrate. In the hours following the successful moon landing, they work tirelessly at MIT's instrumentation lab to determine the cause of the computer's alarms. They can't risk something happening when the spacecraft starts its return journey. After all, this is their system, their alarms, their responsibility. Mission Control calls from Houston every 15 minutes, hounding the software engineers for information.
This is Houston. What were those alarms? We're launching them back in 24 hours.
We understand it. We're on it. Margaret, that was Houston. They keep calling. We need to get to the bottom of this ASAP. Why is the computer running so slowly? It seems to be operating at about 80% of its normal speed.
Let's get the simulation facilities on the phone. Maybe they've seen this before. Otherwise, we can try to recreate the in-flight conditions and go from there.
Time is running out for the team to work out the cause of the alarms. But they have cutting-edge technology on their side. A digital simulation module can mathematically represent the spacecraft's motion and the gravitational environment. Hamilton's team pores over pages of printed-out code, trying to spark an idea of what the problem could be. Finally, after working well into the night, one of the engineers has a thought.
The rendezvous radar switch isn't on, is it?
It shouldn't be. That switch is only meant to be used for ascending flights, not descending flights.
Well, in all of our pre-flight simulations, I can only recall one instance where the guidance computer ran this slowly. And that's because we had turned that switch on during a descending flight. The computer was using up most of its processing power, looking for radar data that wasn't actually there.
The engineers rushed to confirm this theory, checking the telemetry readings transmitted directly from the spacecraft. It turns out that, yes, the rendezvous radar switch is in fact on. The astronauts had been mistakenly trained to switch it on before the descent, or at least that's what it's said to do in their 4-inch-thick book of astronaut procedures. Just as Hamilton had feared, someone, the person writing the procedures manual, had made a simple yet important mistake, and it was all playing out during a real spaceflight. But there is no time for her and the other engineers to reflect on this unfortunate irony. The final countdown to the Apollo's ascent is imminent. Just before liftoff from the moon, the flight director calmly tells the astronauts to please put the rendezvous radar switch in the manual position. In other words, flip the switch off. On July 24, 1969, the Apollo command module splashed down in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, bobbing like a large buoy among the waves. 9 days after they'd been launched into space, the astronauts were home safely. Hamilton may not have been able to install a failsafe for every possible contingency, but her team's smart design did save the day. They'd built the software to focus on high-priority tasks and ignore less important information. And because of that, the spacecraft was able to land, despite the simple human error. After the moon landing, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong became national heroes. But in the years that followed that fateful day in 1969, Hamilton wasn't recognized by the public for her contributions. Behind the scenes, she continued to make numerous contributions to the field of software engineering, an industry she had helped to found. Apollo's software was adapted for the first U.S. space station, Skylab, and for NASA's space shuttle. In 1986, she founded her own software development company, Hamilton Technologies Incorporated. Today, there are hundreds of thousands of computer programmers in the U.S., and software engineering is taught at nearly every university and technical college.
Welcome to the White House, everybody. Today, we celebrate extraordinary Americans who have lifted our spirits, strengthened our union, pushed us towards progress.
Hamilton finally got her due gratitude in 2016, when President Barack Obama honored her many achievements in science, math, and technology by awarding her the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
3 minutes before Armstrong and Aldrin touched down on the moon, Apollo 11's lunar lander alarms triggered. Red and yellow lights across the board. Our astronauts didn't have much time, but thankfully they had Margaret Hamilton.
Her achievements have also been memorialized with a Lego action figure, introduced in 2017 as part of Lego's Women of NASA collection. It portrays Hamilton as a tiny, big-haired, bespectacled hero, with printouts of her Apollo code stacked up taller than she was. The National Air and Space Museum now holds the prototypes for these action figures.
So when Margaret Hamilton was once describing the work of herself and her colleagues, she said, "We had no choice but to be pioneers." And I think that
that's Teasel Muir Harmony, again from the Smithsonian. She and the Smithsonian's Paul Ceruzzi sat down with Beth Pye Lieberman of Smithsonian Magazine to talk more about Margaret Hamilton and her legacy. I've got Beth here with me today. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Stephen. Great to be here.
So, Beth, first of all, thank you so much and all the folks at the Smithsonian for inviting us into your museum.
Well, you're quite welcome. It's been really a lot of fun.
So you met Teasel and Paul to talk more about Margaret Hamilton.
Yes, Teasel and Paul and I met just south of the National Mall in their new temporary offices. They're really excited right now because the museum is undergoing a massive 7-year renovation, and they're looking forward to their new exhibitions, which will be bringing a whole new 21st century sensibility to their work. We talked about space exploration, Margaret Hamilton, and how a lot of the technology we have today traces back to the Apollo program and the software her team developed.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. Let's listen to a little bit of that conversation.
Sputnik was launched in 1957, and President Kennedy proposed Project Apollo in 61, and this was a brand new field. And when President Kennedy proposed Apollo, the U.S. had only about 15 minutes of experience in human spaceflight with Alan Shepard's flight. So everyone working on the program could be considered pioneers. They had to develop all sorts of new capabilities, new technology, managerial skills, all sorts of things. And she was very much a part of that culture.
She's known now as the mother of software, and she popularized the term software engineering, really.
That's correct.
So and some people at the time scoffed at that because they thought she was overinflating her importance here. But how would you say her work impacts us today?
Well, I think it's very interesting to realize that we use software every day with things like Facebook and Google, but we also tolerate a lot of errors. We often get announcements from the company saying we have a bug fix or we're updating the operating system because there was a problem. When you're flying to the moon or you're flying on an airplane that runs on computer software, which all modern aircraft do, the software has to be correct. You can't have the companies say to you, oh, by the way, we're going to give you a fix and you're in the middle, you're 30,000 feet up in the sky. So it's got to be correct and it's got to be checked and checked over again and tested. And that's where she was a pioneer and her companies that she founded were pioneers in this notion that we check everything before you trust human lives to it. That kind of software is very, very different from the kind of consumer software you have on your phone.
So after that dramatic moment landing on the moon, what has she gone on to work on since?
Well, the whole question of whether you can validate software to prove that it's correct is one that has really been an obsession with computer scientists ever since. And some of them say it's impossible. Others say it's just barely possible, and here's some techniques to do it. She developed a set of techniques. She founded a company, Higher Order Software, later Hamilton Technologies, where she promoted these tools that she developed to allow you to check things. And that is, it's not entirely agreed upon that they work. They certainly haven't solved the problem completely, but we do know that a lot of aerospace software today works pretty well. I can just put it that way. The recent New Horizons mission that went out beyond Pluto is a good example of that. If you're going to Pluto, you can't fix the software. If there's a bug in it, you miss Pluto and the other heavenly bodies it's going to. So it does seem to work. I wouldn't say that she would get sole credit for that, but she certainly deserves credit as someone who promoted that concept right from the very beginning.
So much of modern day life comes from the technology that was developed for us to get to the moon.
That's correct. The Apollo guidance computer, the myth is that when a Saturn rocket took off, it took almost most of the existing integrated circuits in the whole world with it, which is kind of crazy, but not quite true. But it was integrated circuits or silicon chips were brand new at the time.
Teasel, what impact do you see her as having on women in science today?
Well, I think one of Margaret Hamilton's important impacts is that she was an advocate of equal rights, and not just equal rights for women, but for everyone. And she thought that everyone should be given opportunities and access, and fought for that in a number of different areas.
That was the Smithsonian Magazine's Beth Pye Lieberman speaking with Teasel Muir Harmony and Paul Ceruzzi from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. Beth, thanks for sharing that with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
The National Air and Space Museum is in the midst of marking the 50th anniversary of the Apollo program. A five-day celebration is planned for July 16 through July 20 on the National Mall. And for the first time in 13 years, Neil Armstrong's newly conserved spacesuit is going on view. For an even deeper dive into Margaret Hamilton and other women inventors, and to hear more about related exhibits and resources at the Smithsonian Institution, go to smithsonian.com/wondery. You'll also find an image there of Margaret's Apollo 11 software printout, which you can make an appointment to see at the Smithsonian's archives. On the next episode of American Innovations, we are going back in time, digging into the roots of today's cosmetics industry and the life of Madam C.J. Walker. Thank you for listening to American Innovations. If you like our series, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and every major listening app, as well as at Wondery.com. And also check us out on Twitter. We're at InnovationsPod. We'd also like to learn more about you. Please complete a short survey at wondery.com/survey. That's wondery.com/survey. You'll have an opportunity to tell us what you like about this show and what you'd love to hear in future episodes. If you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast. You'll find the episode notes, including some details you might have missed. And a quick note about these historical recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said. Those scenes are dramatizations, but they're based on historical research. You can find some of the articles we found useful in the episode notes. American Innovations is hosted by me, Stephen Johnson. For more information about my books on the history of innovation and technology, you can visit my website at stephenberlinjohnson.com. Sound design on this episode is by Spoke Media. This episode was written by Sarah Whitman, with editing by Lindsay Cradwell. Special thanks to Beth Pye Lieberman, Megan Gambino, Brian Wally, Jane Recker, Paul Ceruzzi, and Teasel Muir Harmony, and all the folks at the Smithsonian and Smithsonian Magazine. Our producers are Katie Long and George Lavender. American Innovations is executive produced by Marshall Louis for Wondery.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.